Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. From Washington, coming up, a new U.S.-Philippine agreement is signed. Australia says the Malaysian missing plane search is moving into a new phase.
By this stage, 52 days into the search, most material would have become waterlogged and sunk.
The U.S. is adding more Russian sanctions, a call for Syria to hand over its remaining chemical materials, and a look at the safety of vaccines. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United States and the Philippines today signed a 10-year agreement that President Obama says will give U.S. military personnel greater access to Filipino facilities, airfields, and ports. However, Mr. Obama, during a joint news conference with his Philippine counterpart, Benigno Aquino, said the pact will allow U.S. forces to rotate through for joint training and exercises and not result in permanent U.S. bases.
I want to be very clear. The United States is not trying to reclaim old bases or build new bases. At the invitation of the Philippines, American service members will rotate through Filipino facilities.
The agreement was signed earlier today by Philippines Defense Secretary Baltar Gosman and U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg before Mr. Obama's arrival in the country.
Through joint exercises, training, and subject matter expert exchanges to increase their capabilities and interoperability, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or EDCA, serves as recognition by both sides that there is even more we can do together to support the alliance and to promote peace and security in the region.
In a commentary today, the official Chinese news agency Xinhua said the agreement may embolden Manila in dealing with Beijing over their maritime dispute in the South China Sea. Xinhua called the Philippines a troublemaker who has encroached upon Chinese territory and harassed Chinese fishing boats, and warned the pact may lead to further provocation. During a pre-trip briefing, Deputy U.S. National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said the agreement with Manila will focus on disaster response and counter-piracy activities. He said the United States will be a stabilizing presence in the free flow of commerce, open sea lanes, and is not at China's expense.
The U.S. engagement with Southeast Asia is not at China's expense, but rather is part of a broader strategy in which we can deepen our ties with ASEAN countries, but also maintain very constructive ties with China as well. And ultimately, what we're seeking to build together in partnership with other Asian and Pacific nations is a rules-based architecture for how you resolve economic disputes, how you resolve territorial disputes, so that there don't need to be tension and conflict. And I think that's consistent with new model great power relations that President Xi has laid out, which is that an emerging power does not inherently have to come into conflict with an established power like the United States.
President Obama, in his interview, called on China to support efforts to manage and resolve maritime and territorial disputes through dialogue, not intimidation, including the South China Sea. Peter Dean, Director of Studies at the Australian National University's Strategic and Defense Studies Center, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the agreement differs from the president's unequivocal support for Japan's administration of disputed islands in the East China Sea.
What is clear is that the Senkaku Islands are clearly covered by the current existing alliance with Japan, and Obama made that very clear. With the territorial disputes between the Philippines and China in the South China Sea, because they are disputed territories and there's not a direct, already well-established Philippine claim, the American government sees that as being somewhat different. So I think they will use this to monitor those areas, to keep an eye on, and of course this provides a great deal of reassurance to the Philippines more generally about the rise of China, that it won't necessarily specifically focus on some of these particular disputes the Philippines and China have in the South China Sea. While these particular areas we're talking about between the Philippines and China, they sit within the internationally mandated exclusive economic zone of the Philippines and over 1,000 kilometres away from the nearest Chinese landmass. That's why there is more of an inclination of international law of siding with the Philippines. However, they're more hypothetical in the sense that there's not a clear territorial administration or occupation on behalf of the Philippines. So there is not this sort of concrete, cemented administrative control that the Japanese have over the Senkaku Islands. So what I think is going to be interesting here is why Obama's defense pact will provide broader reassurance to the Philippines. under their current mutual defense treaty, what the Americans, I think, will also be attempting to do is also to restrain the Philippines in a number of ways of not to act too aggressively towards the Philippines and not stake too much on some of these territorial claims, some minor territorial claims in the South China Sea.
How do you expect China to react to this?
China will probably react in a similar way that they've done to some of the other statements about what Obama said in his trip to the region. Of course, the Chinese position is very much firmly that the U.S.-San Francisco alliance system is actually holding back the region from being able to develop on its own accord, and they claim that, of course, these alliance systems are left over from the Cold War. However, the interesting facet remains for these countries, such as Japan and the Philippines, Thailand and South Korea, with the more assertive that China has been, the more that they're actually inclined to fall back upon these American traditional alliances that have been around since the 1940s and the 1950s. So I think we'll see the same type of rhetoric out of China in relation to this and as they have in the last few weeks. But I don't think that will change, of course, the course of what the Philippines and the United States or what the United States more generally is doing in the region.
Dean says the U.S.-Philippine Security Pact is a reaction to China's more assertive behavior in the East and South China Seas, not as a way to contain China. And he says it provides reassurance to America's Asian allies. The air search for debris from a missing airliner in the Indian Ocean is ending today, and Australian officials are dampening expectations that a soon-to-be-enlarged search of the ocean's floor is likely to quickly spot any wreckage from the missing Malaysian Airlines jet. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott says he is baffled and disappointed that searchers have not been able to find MH370. Mr. Abbott, speaking to reporters Monday in Canberra, announced that an expanded underwater area will be combed to try to find any remains of the airliner missing since March 8th.
But it is highly unlikely at this stage that we will find any aircraft debris on the ocean surface. By this stage, 52 days into the search, most material would have become waterlogged and sunk. And with the distances involved, all of the aircraft are operating at close to the limit of sensible and safe operation. Therefore, we are moving from the current phase to a phase which is focused on searching the ocean floor over a much larger area.
That, according to the Prime Minister, is an area 700 kilometres long and 80 kilometres wide. Mr. Abbott says Australia will seek contributions from other countries to help share the cost of using new equipment for the search in an area where the ocean's depth reaches 7 kilometres. The search, the most expensive in aviation history, besides Australia, has also involved equipment and personnel from Britain, China, Japan, Malaysia, New Zealand, South Korea, and the United States. Weeks of scouring the bottom of the ocean in a 400-square-kilometer area, where acoustic signals from the plane's black boxes were said to have been detected, utilizing a U.S. Navy robotic submarine, has turned up no trace of the Boeing 777 jetliner. Using equipment in the deep sea to survey the larger area is a daunting task. The head of the search effort, Angus Houston, says if everything goes perfectly, the extended underwater search will take 8 months to complete. For unknown reasons, the Malaysia airliner veered far off course on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The plane was carrying 239 passengers and crew. No trace of the aircraft has been found, despite an extensive search with aircraft and boats, in addition to using the Bluefin 21 submersible. Analysis of routine data sent to satellites by the plane's engines determined that the jet likely ran out of fuel off the western coast of Australia in one of the most remote places in the world. The Australian Prime Minister, directing comments at the anguished, mostly Chinese families of the missing, says everything humanely possible will be done to solve the mystery.
We will not let people down. And while the search will be moving to a new phase in coming weeks, it certainly is not ending.
However, Mr. Abbott also acknowledges it is possible nothing will ever be found of the missing airliner. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
United States is announcing new sanctions against Russia for its ongoing involvement in neighboring Ukraine. President Barack Obama said today the sanctions against individuals and companies will build on a set already in place, targeting some banking activities and corporate officials close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Mr. Obama said Ukraine has abided by an international agreement reached in Geneva earlier this month that set out concrete steps to resolve the crisis. He told reporters during a trip to the Philippines that Russia has not taken comparable actions. The president said if Russia shows further aggression against Ukraine, then the United States could take additional steps, including broader sanctions against sectors such as banking or the defense industry. For some analysis of the Ukraine crisis, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two scholars. Ariel Cohen, senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian studies and international energy policy at the Heritage Foundation, plus William Pomeranz, deputy director, Kenyan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Cohen said the current Ukrainian crisis is the most serious security concern so far of the 21st century.
It has at least two components I can see. One is the regional component. It's relationship between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine, of course, was partitioned and occupied by Russia and Poland and Turkey, even before the partitions of Poland. And Russia today is reverting to the rhetoric that we did not see since the Tsarist times, denying the Ukrainians peoplehood, national identity, statehood, and language. One of the top Russian propagandists, Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT TV channel, tweeted, "Ukraine, RIP, rest in peace." This is nothing short of, I would say, near genocidal intent. When you deny a country its right to exist, it is very, very severe. It violates the UN Charter, and it raises very deep questions about security in Europe. But beyond that, the second part of this problem is what Russia is doing, bringing back ethnicity and culture as the base of foreign policy and not citizenship and established borders. This has implications because everyone has co-ethnics living across the border, and the darkest era of the 20th century, late 1930s and 40s, was cloaked in the protection of co-ethnics in Central Europe, in Austria with the Anschluss, and in Sudetenland with the reunification of the German-speaking people. And finally, this is the question about the post-World War II global order that for decades was based on American power. During the Cold War, the balance between the U.S. and the USSR, and after the end of the Cold War, it for a while looked like the triumph of liberal democracy. Some people even wrote books about the end of history, and as I equipped at that time, history did not end, neither did geography. Geography dictates what's going on around the world, including in Ukraine right now, and this is a very serious challenge to the Obama administration after setbacks in the Middle East, in East Asia, and now in Europe.
Turning to you, William Pomeranz, certainly regional problems insinuating that Ukraine perhaps shouldn't exist, RIP, rest in peace. We are going backwards, it seems. In addition to that, we have this whole challenge to the global world order, post-World War II order. How do you see the situation to date?
Well, Ariel is right that Russia has made this decision to deny notions of Ukrainian statehood and ethnicity. And it was very revealing when Putin pulled up his map of sometime during Catherine the Great's reign and pointed to New Russia, which of course denies all the things that occurred in Ukraine or what was Ukraine during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. It was really a very blatant statement. And Ariel is right as well. The notion of Ukraine was always denied throughout the Tsarist period. There were massive restrictions on the use of Ukrainian language, Ukrainian culture. And the fact that somehow Putin has decided to retreat back to 18th century thinking is, of course, very dangerous in terms of the 21st century that we live in.
Okay, so we all agree it's very dangerous and escalating by the minute. So, Ariel Cohen, one more look back at history as if we could really change things, but it's important to put things in context. In retrospect, did the United States, did the European Union make some mistakes, perhaps, about expanding NATO and the EU into the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries. This does not justify in any way Putin's belligerent actions, but he talks about this sphere of influence in addition to ethnic groups and protecting ethnic minorities, Russian-speaking minorities. To what extent do you think the West is paying for what some say maybe were overzealous overtures to the former Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries?
What you described is an opinion. It's a minority opinion that prevails in Washington in what I would call the ultra-realist school. The people who could be identified maybe with the Nixon administration and with the Bush senior administration. There are some people like that. You hear this opinion that we should not have expanded NATO. I must say that both Republicans and Democrats in Clinton and Bush II administrations, so four administrations, were staunch supporters of Europe whole and free, of expanding NATO and the European Union, and if eventually the United States, the EU, and Japan end up in a free trade zone, together with Mexico and Canada, of course, this would be a tremendous achievement for freedom, for economic freedom, for the rule of law. So I am not an opponent of expansion of NATO. I think there may have been a tenuous opportunity to reach out to the Russians more and drag the Russians in inviting and pulling Russia into that center of gravity, including things like free travel to Europe, etc. Today, unfortunately, we pass that point. Mr. Putin believes that Russia can be a pole in the multipolar world. Whatever that is, what I think it really means to translate is that Russia will be a raw material appendage, not to the West, but to China. And if the Russians think that this is a preferable geopolitical outcome, so be it. But I would say if you have to apportion the responsibility here, it is the policy of reset with Russia that was, from the get-go, mistranslated.
Ariel Cohen is a senior research fellow in Russian and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He and William Pomeranz, Deputy Director, Kenyan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter under the Programs tab. The international watchdog charged with getting chemical weapons out of Syria is calling on the government to hand over its remaining materials. Sigrid Kaag, special coordinator of the joint mission of the United Nations and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, told a news conference in Damascus Sunday that more than 92% of Syria's chemicals have been removed from the country or destroyed so far.
I strongly encourage the authorities to complete the job as soon as possible, in the proximity of Syria's own internal deadline of 27th of April, so the 30th of June deadline can be met.
Washington and its Western allies have blamed Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces for unleashing the deadly nerve agent sarin. The Syrian government blamed the rebels for the use of sarin. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will travel to sub-Saharan Africa this week with stops in Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. Here is Mr. Kerry's spokesperson, Jennifer Saki.
On the trip, he will encourage democratic development, promote respect for human rights, advance peace and security, engage with civil society and young African leaders who will shape the continent's future, and promote trade, investment, and development partnerships in Africa. The Secretary's trip will also highlight U.S. investments in the PEPFAR program. In Addis Ababa, Secretary Kerry will co-convene the fourth session of the US-AU high-level dialogue and discuss a range of issues on which we partner with the African Union. Secretary Kerry will meet with both the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister to discuss efforts to advance peace and democracy in the region and strengthen important areas of bilateral cooperation with Ethiopia. In Kinshasa, Secretary Kerry will meet with President Kabila and will discuss how the DRC's government's progress in neutralizing some of the dozens of dangerous armed groups that victimize the Congolese people can be consolidated, and how to best advance the DRC's democratization and long-term stability, including through a timely and transparent electoral process. In Luanda, Secretary Kerry will commend President Dos Santos for Angola's leadership of the International Conference on the Great Lakes region and encourage the President's continued personal engagement in the Great Lakes peace process. The Secretary will also discuss bilateral policy and trade issues with the Foreign Minister.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki said Secretary Kerry visited North and West Africa earlier this month. His trip included a stop in Algiers, where he met with officials to discuss ways to combat terrorism and strengthen security in the region. The World Health Organization is urging adults to get their children immunized against deadly and debilitating diseases and to make sure their own immunizations are up to date. The WHO observes World Immunization Week up to April 30th. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on the safety of vaccines and a controversy about them.
The international push to eliminate polio has put this disease on the verge of eradication worldwide. When that happens, no one will ever suffer paralysis or death from polio again. India is the latest country to become polio-free. The Gavi Alliance is one of the organizations that gets vaccines to children in developing countries. Dr. Seth Berkley is Gavi's chief executive officer.
Since we started, we've immunized more than 440 million additional children and have prevented more than 6 million deaths. The challenges that sit in front of us are that there are still about 22 million children that are not fully immunized.
The World Health Organization reports that immunization prevents 2 to 3 million deaths per year from childhood diseases and two types of cancer. This year, the WHO is encouraging people to make sure their families' immunizations are up to date. And while most parents in developing countries want their children immunized, a growing number of parents in Western countries are choosing not to. Steve and Victoria Carrico are among them.
We told them no vaccinations right off the bat.
Like most parents who choose not to vaccinate their children, the Caricos say they are concerned about possible side effects. At the U.S. National Institutes of Health, Dr. Anthony Fauci says in developed countries, the success of vaccines has been their downfall.
Years and years ago, when there were many children throughout the world, developed countries and developing nations, getting ill and dying or being maimed from diseases like polio, measles, mumps, rubella, hemophilus, vaccinations were so successful in decreasing the burden of disease that people now, when they think about vaccination, they think about the very rare event of a possible adverse event from a vaccine and shy away from vaccines, thinking that vaccines are the problem, when in fact vaccines are preventing us from getting very serious illness.
Dr. Berkley says money spent on vaccines means less money is needed to treat disease and disability.
Vaccines are, among the most effective and cost-effective interventions that exist.
Dr. Berkley says some parents worry that a vaccine might be damaged if it's not properly refrigerated. He says such a situation might make the vaccine ineffective, but it is not likely to make it harmful. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
A strong storm system moving across the central and southern United States has spawned several tornadoes, killing at least 16 people. An outbreak forecasters say could continue today as the storms continue traveling to the east. The suburbs of Little Rock, Arkansas, was the hardest hit area Sunday. Officials in the southern states say tornadoes killed at least 15 people there. Another person died earlier Sunday after a tornado touched down in the south central state of Oklahoma. The powerful winds from the tornadoes also destroyed dozens of homes, knocked down trees, and flipped over cars. President Barack Obama expressed his condolences to the victims today during a visit to the Philippines and said the government would help those affected to recover and rebuild. The National Weather Service warned of potentially strong storms with tornadoes today in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee. The storm system is hitting on the third anniversary of one of the worst tornado outbreaks in U.S. history, which killed more than 300 people and included nearly 300 reported tornadoes across the nation's southeast. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 28, 1758, James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president, was born. Monroe is best known for the doctrine that bears his name. It discouraged European interference in the Western Hemisphere, seeking to avoid any attempts to make the New World a battleground for Old World nations. On April 28, 1881, U.S. outlaw and folk hero William H. Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid, escaped from a courthouse jail in New Mexico. The Kid had been awaiting execution, having been found guilty of murder. 3 months later, the icon of the American Wild West was shot and killed by a sheriff. In 1908, ethnic German businessman Oskar Schindler was born in what is now the Czech Republic. Schindler saved the lives of hundreds of his Jewish factory workers during World War II. His efforts are recounted in the book and movie Schindler's List. In 1937, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was born, leading his country into two devastating wars. Saddam's nearly 25-year rule was characterized by brutal suppression of internal dissent. He was overthrown in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was captured later that year, tried, and later executed. In 1945, Italian communist partisans executed former dictator Benito Mussolini and his mistress as the fascist leader attempted to flee to Switzerland near the close of World War II. On this day in 1969, Charles de Gaulle resigned as president of France after his proposals for constitutional reform were defeated in a national referendum. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel recently visited Mongolia on a 10-day trip to Asia. "I wanted to visit Mongolia," said Mr. Hagel, "because it's a valued partner of the United States. As one of the world's fastest-growing economies, Mongolia has a growing stake in regional and global security. On the basis of these many shared interests, our nations built strong economic, diplomatic, and security ties." During the visit, the U.S. and Mongolia signed a joint vision statement, highlighting the importance of enhancing defense cooperation and supporting Mongolia's peacekeeping capabilities. The United States provides Mongolia with $2 million a year in military aid and spends about $1 million on training programs for the country's armed forces. Mongolia continues to be a strong partner in coalition operations, with approximately 350 troops still serving in Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Hagel thanked Mongolia for its participation in United Nations peacekeeping operations and its previous 10 rotations of troops in Iraq. The Mongolian military, which has about 10,000 troops, is expanding as the country builds a 3,000-member brigade intended to specialize in peacekeeping operations. Mongolia wants to be more than a passive observer in the international arena, said Mongolian Defense Minister Bat Erdene. We want to be actively engaged in international operations and in strengthening world and regional peace. A strong U.S.-Mongolia defense relationship is important to America's rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. There are many challenges facing all nations of this region today, said Defense Secretary Hagel, but also many opportunities. We must continue to work together to seize these opportunities as well as build a better future for all of our people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C.